This is Joe Leith speaking at the 1977 Founders Day Breakfast in Akron, Ohio.
The gentleman I'm about to introduce, he's unique in his own way. You don't find many speakers who travel around the country carrying their own entourage with them. Is that correct? Now, Joe does. He has with him this morning his hairdresser, his doctor, and the other one's an interior decorator and I think part-time psychiatrist. I'm not sure what his function is. But these are three terrific gentlemen and I wish they would stand up, as Clancy says, and get a little juice. This is Don, Carl, and Howard. Now, we have only known Joe since noon Friday, but it's been an enjoyable 3 days, very much so. He comes through to me as a compassionate man, a sincere man, and a man who is dedicated to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He has in my opinion, a tremendous story, and so it is with a distinct honor and a great deal of pleasure that I introduce our speaker for this morning. And if you'll put your palms together and help me welcome Joe Tyler from Tyler. Joe Tyler? Joe Leith, Tyler, Texas.
My name is Joe and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from the suburban group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Tyler, Texas. And I hasten to add that it's the best AA group in the country. And if you don't think your group's the best one in the country, you ought to start one or go to another. I'd have to add something to this entourage that I brought with me. I've been a victim of a very dirty trick. They sent three people up here to be sure that I told my story and not somebody else's. And I brought my doctor, my hairdresser, and an interior decorator. The interior decorator's queer. He's married to a woman. And the doctor is a typical alcoholic doctor. He treats me at rare intervals. He's a diagnostician. And I said to him not too long ago, I said, "Doctor, my complexion is turning yellow." And he just did it like that. He said, "You ought to wear a brown tie." But these guys are great, and I'm glad they're with me. And some of the things that I would have told you if they hadn't been here. Now, the publicity you saw on that flyer, that the pre-dating thing that had a word on there, is very nasty, and it's not true. This word, wino. We just did that for publicity purposes to get you here. Because in AA, it proves that there is never any forgiveness for your sins. You can play the piano all your life and never be a musician. And you can drink a few little drinks of wine medicinally and you're a damn wino the rest of your life. But there is something peculiar about winos now that I think of it. And wine is a very fine fluid. And people make fun of it. It's a very nourishing thing. They say that some people drink it to help their appetite. I always drank it, and it helped my appetite for another drink. And it has some very strange medicinal purposes. The medical profession has never been able to do anything about a bad cold. and wine will cure hay fever. If you drink it like I did, you don't dare sneeze. If you do, you'll feel like you've been born to the purple. But that's not what I'm here for. The magnificence of this occasion is absolutely overwhelming for us, and I ran into one of your local members this morning and was looking for a description to find out what was happening here, what has happened here heretofore. And this fellow looked at me and he said, "There seems to be something in the air." And I thought that's the greatest description. We, the survivors, and that's what we are, this morning are feasting at a table that was prepared for us 42 years ago. We received a gift, not one gift, but many. I think our gift is threefold. The first part of it was the fact that these two men devised a method for us to shake the chains of alcoholism and get well again. That's the gift number one. And the second and more important gift, I think, is the fact that they proved that it would work by working it. The second gift. And the third gift that we received is the fact that after they proved that it would work by working it, they wrote it down. And this makes us a fortunate minority in society, because we have a book that we can all meet on in a common ground that's manually instructive, and it has no compromises in the first 186 pages of it. We're most indeed fortunate that first they devised it, they proved that it would work by working it, and they wrote it down. And I think that each of us in our individual universe of the person consciousness have had to accept whatever part we could take of this. And I think it meets no compromise when it comes to gratitude. And I think that one of the greatest gifts in our book of experience has in it over 147 promises. And I should love to report to you that if we can fulfill the contingencies of the request in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, these promises will be fulfilled 1,000-fold. And I wish to record my thanks to you people who took me in against my own will. And I thank you very much for this letting me be present at this occasion. I was with Bill, our beloved Bill, in 1966 in Indianapolis, and he just returned from the funeral of Sister Ignatia. And you would think there would have been a touch of sadness in the air. And he got up that Sunday morning and he said, "You know, as I followed Sister Ignatia's remains across the cemetery, I discovered that it was a day of rejoicing and not a day of sorrow." And I think that's what we have here at this 42nd anniversary of the gift of recovery. I want to thank you so very much for it, because it's not a matter of worthiness, it's a matter of intellectuality, which I will prove later, that we got here. I came up here not to tell Dr. Bob's story and her bills, but that of Sister Ignatia won't tell mine, because it's the only one I know. And these three louses came up here to be sure I didn't lie about it. So we'll visit with you for a little while on the spiritual basis that you started with those two jokes. And I'd like to, you know, hammer around here a little bit. It's a hell of an old tax father an Indian anywhere. They leave bad tracks. But he did a beautiful job. You're a great man. I want to record my thanks to you. And I suspect that as we progress down the line of this way of life that we've encompassed, Bill said that our perpetuation of this society hangs upon the thread of personal narrative. That's the story handed down. And these two men in the beginning filled the vacuum of their souls by using the language of the heart to obtain their first sobriety. And this has been this thing that's been handed down. And incidentally, in the research of the whole thing, I can trace the genealogy, if you please, as though it were an apostolic succession from Dr. Bob to my front door. This is an amazing thing. Makes it more fascinating to me. But I drank. How the hell did I drink? I drank. And my first encounter with it was at age 17. Innocently, of course. I drank to be one of the kids the first time out. You know, the boys, I'd heard about drinking. And I had an old uncle who was a recluse. And people looked at drunks in those days. And my old uncle, who was a recluse, was a drunk. And I remember him as a boy. And he used to, every now and then, slip me a nickel. And he rattled a little change in his pocket. And he visited us at intervals. And my people used to use him for the boogeyman in the closet. They'd say, if you don't do right, you'll end up like Uncle Bill. And you know, the more I smelled of him and the more nickels I got, that began to bother me. I kind of wanted to end up like Uncle Bill. But I went to drink this night, just like you did, I guess, and with seven of the boys. And we went out and drank some vile concoction that they made down there in East Texas. And I got sick. And something happened to me that night that didn't happen to these other sick fellows. Some of them I know personally now. But I was different. Now these other fellows, they're still floating around the community. And I guess they're living in that nebulous realm that we describe as drinking. What kind of drinking is that? Social, I believe. That's the same kind of social that you have when you refer to social disease, I guess. I don't know. But they're still in the realm of social drinking. I don't know anything about social drinking. I couldn't talk 5 minutes on social drinking. I know nothing about it. I have a very humble opinion about social drinking, and that is, if you took the most pious and humble old sister out of the church and slapped about 8 slugs of that Gallo in her, she's going to get unsocial as hell. But I can't talk about social drinking. This night, that drink did something to me. I have no way of describing it. I remember some of the feelings, the great exhilaration. It set me free. Let me feel like I had become a part of the planet, this hostile planet that I was on. And I could use it. And I'll have to use that term. And I think we all went through the same thing. For many years thereafter, there was a feeling in the back of my mind that whatever occurred, a drink would help it. So I began to use alcohol. There's a lot of difference between living to drink and drinking to live. This is where they used to talk about crossing over some invisible line. I usually fell over them. I never And Tyler immediately became too small for me after these first few drinks in East Texas Clod, and I moved out. And this is the beginning of the alcoholic progression of geography. We all move. And up until the day that this society was devised, that was the treatment for the alcoholic. Do you know that? Oh, yes, keep it moving. No family likes to admit that they've got one of us, even yet. With all the education that is available, people, no family loves to brag about having an alcoholic in it. Now, I have a nephew that's a psychiatrist. And then I have another nephew that's a homosexual. And my people brag more about them two than they do about me. So if you're talking about erasing the stigma on alcoholism, forget it. You only hear that at AA meetings. They discuss that after they get through talking about the keen alcoholic mind. Just after. And I never have been to a seminar where they had the topic, the keen alcoholic mind. But no family likes to admit they got one of us. And pretty soon I left. And I went to, of all places, for an East Texas clod, I ended up in Hollywood. Not in the movies, of course. But I ended up as an understudy for one of the more fashionable designers of ladies' lingerie. And this is a thing to behold. Or a thing to hold on to, I don't know. A nice, dumb East Texas country kid living on the flush of alcohol and thinking that he was a master at his craft. And they told me that you're going to go a long way here. This fellow took great interest in my education. He was a nice, kind Jewish fellow. And I did establish somewhat of a name for myself in that particular profession. Those of you, if there's any ladies out here today that still got a pinch, I've been gone from there for a long time, so don't blame it on me. But this is where you cut those soft, silk, sleazy, intimate things that the ladies wear. Rather pleasurable occupation. And we have a step in AA that some of these clods don't want to admit to when they come in. It's the second step, where it infers that you might have a gopher in the garden, you know? Now, if you cut a bunch of braziers with three of those places in them, you're nuts. I told a psychiatrist about that, and he said it was just wishful thinking. And needless to say, it wasn't long before I cut myself out of that profession. Completely. And here we go with the beginning of the movement. The progression of alcoholism. And those of you who sit here today and have lost your first job. Those of you who have been told that you're unfit. Those of you who have lived out the dialogue of our book of experience, which makes it so very, very vivid in our minds that we were absolutely defenseless. This is the beginning of the defenselessness of alcoholism. And they dumped me, even though I was a very valuable craftsman and was skilled at my trade. they had to let me go. And I never will forget, this Jewish fellow came to me one day, and he had a rather good sense of humor too, even though I damn near broke him. And he told me, he said, "You got to go." And then he told me a thing that was horrible, a thing that we can't hear. He said to me, "Joe, you can't drink." And this is the most horrible thing, I guess, that the aspirant alcoholic can hear. You know that we go out to prove that we can, and we keep proving that we can't. Then he laughed at me and he said, "There's some good that comes out of everything," he said, and he laughed, and I thought, what a weirdo this is. He said, "I'm sure glad that the way you handle those scissors," he said, "if you'd have been a rabbi, you would have destroyed our whole race." You gotta let that roll around for a little while. Job number one. I would love to tell you here that I have just retired semi. When he ain't doing nothing, you can't tell when he retired. But I have just retired from my fifth profession, all as a result of being an alcoholic. And I wish to report to you with all honesty that in every profession I went into, it was an absolute fraud, which seems to be the habit of the alcoholic. But we sell ourselves as we go along. We prop ourselves up, and we manage to go from the first one to the second one. And the war was going on at that time. And I went to a union hall in San Pedro, and I literally bought, a plumber's license. And I went into one of the big shipyards as a master plumber. Now, this is a guy that's never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors. And you well know that I was a master fraud. No way. But I went in as a master plumber. And those were the horrible days when you were, and some of you remember this, howling, when you were frozen to your job. God, what a thought. Don't say to an alcoholic, "You can't do nothing." "You can't quit," they said to me. And I thought, well, I'll make myself so unpalatable to these people that they'll help me. You know, you can use them against yourself. And it took me possibly 6 months to thaw out. I became unfrozen. And I have a document at home now that is signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. Number two, we're going fast now. We're getting the impetus of alcoholism. And you know, the old drunk says to his wife, none of you have ever heard this plea, have you? None of you of dear Al-Anon. When he says, "Honey, let's go somewhere else where nobody knows us. Let's start all over again." None of you have ever heard that cry of the alcoholic, have you? Well, there's one thing wrong with moving an alcoholic from place A to place B. And that is that when you get him there, he's there. This is the only flaw. And he's just as active and functionable, if that's a good word, when he gets to place B as he was in A, you know. He's still what he is, and that's it. Who was I talking about? The compulsion here? He's compulsed, and he's obsessed, and that's all there is to it. And I went to work for, of all places, I'm almost ashamed to tell you this. I went to work for the railroad. And I'd love to say here that they're the narrow-minded, this group of people, that I've ever met. They have a rule about drinking. And it reads that if you're seen coming out of an establishment that dispenses alcoholic beverages, you can be discharged. I never came out very often. And if it did then, it was from duress and coercion. I never came out voluntarily. Did any of you at 9 o'clock in the afternoon ever smack your lips and say to yourself, "That's enough, I've had it"? I never met anybody like that in AA. We all had the key to the bar. We opened it and closed it. This was a way of life, as we talk about in AA. So I went to work for the railroad, and they're a sticky bunch, real sticky bunch. And I suspect that they had this rule about drinking. They ran more than one train on a track. And as long as I worked for them, I never did figure it out. It always frightened me to know that somebody was coming toward me. And I never quite comprehended how they did it. And I lived in a state of constant fear, or hangover, if you please. And then they made the mistake. One day they hung a bulletin up in the depot in Sacramento, and it said, in essence, "You can't." And that was driving alcoholic crazy. We had an interlocking system at the top of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And when you got up to the top of the mountain, you cut all your helper engines off. We used four engines in those days. And then you use one engine to go down the other side. And it was a great big thing, very complicated. And they did it with these electronic system, you know, lights and switches, and you didn't even see the man that was working them. And they put on this bulletin in the depot. And I want you to hear this clearly. The bulletin read, in essence, "It is physically impossible to make a mistake there." It is so electronically perfect that it is physically impossible to make a mistake. Well, that'll drive a drunk crazy. You can't. And I did. Through some quirk of alcoholic circumstance, I got two engines going towards one another with four cars between them of carrots, apples, lettuce, and celery. And I made the biggest goddamn fruit salad that I've ever known at that time. And these people wanted to fire me. I had destroyed their system. And they flew two engineers out from the Sperry Company, if you please, and they followed me around. And in my every waking moment, they'd say to me, "Do you remember now how you did it?" "How'd you do it?" And I couldn't tell. Really, you know, mechanically so, or engineeringly so. And these two fellows had been sent out to find what was the flaw in this system. This goddamn drunk had screwed up the whole railroad. You know? And late one night, they were harassing me. And I said, "I'll tell you what you do. If you buy me a quart, I'm going to go up there and try it again." Don't you ever tell a drunk you can't. You shouldn't. And good God Almighty, I've heard you ought to. all through my drinking days, particularly from a very close friend of my family. You ought to. You shouldn't. You can't. I dare you to. And this is the progression of the alcoholic, living on a hostile planet in a state of threat, constant threat. And then he's got this damned old disease to contend with. Everything's coming at him at once. And he goes crazy. This is all there is to it. They talk of the insanity of alcoholism. I think folks do it to us. And we keep on. Keep on and do it. You know, there's some lines in our book of experience. In the little Dr. Silkworth's dissertation in the front of the book. Says he thinks that he's leading a perfectly normal life. And after a time, it says in our book, he cannot distinguish the true from the false. This is the state of an alcoholic. So you see, maybe these drunks that come to visit with us, looking for the thing that we have found, maybe we expect them to come up to us, but we can't do it. We've got to get down with them. Thank you. Is this better? Raise your hand. Not that fella that's named Viola, don't you raise your hand. Can you hear now? I'm so sorry. These things are like an old barroom spittoon. If you don't get the proper aim on them, you can make a hell of a mess. But you know, through the whole course of our drinking, we cannot escape that word in our book, defenseless. Until we find the defenses of Alcoholics Anonymous and that enables us to stand up again. And we follow the whole course of defenselessness. We do not know the truth from the false. And really, we do not know how we feel after a time. I'll tell you a little story that I've been asked to tell it, and I think my stomach's up to it. And it may describe that a drunk really doesn't know how he feels. Years ago, I lived in a town in Texas called Goose Creek. If you look for it now, it is not on the map. Goose Creek is not there anymore. I don't know whether I had anything to do with it or not. But and my wife and I, Mary, most of you folks know Mary, we have always had cats. We love them. We've had all kinds of cats, you know, fat cats, good cats, little cats, inside cats, and outside cats. But we've always had cats. We don't have any children. There must be something for us to shower our love upon. And this has been many years ago. And my wife went off up into Illinois to help her sister have a baby. And while she was gone, I got fired from whatever I was doing. I forget it. Not what it was, but I got fired. And the processes in those days, I know none of you people have ever done this, whenever I got fired, I always went home to Mama. Mama had a good purse and a nice place to get over it, and then I could barge out from there. Goose Creek is 300 miles from Tyler. And I remember this evening, I threw these two cats that I dared not bring home, or dared not get home without, and I put them in the back of this little 1931, late 1931, Chevrolet. And we started for Tyler. Louder? Can you turn it up a little? Huh? You think, am I gone? I just thought I'd been struck dead. Is that any better?
Yes.
And we started for Tyler, me and the two cats. And it was late in the evening, and it was cool and misting rain. Beautiful evening. And as I drove through the outskirts of Houston, you got too much there now. I'll cut my hair and hang it off. I saw a sign that read, 3 pints for the price of 2. And not being one to ever pass up a bargain, I bought the 3 pints for the price of 2 and headed north towards Tyler. And it had begun to rain by this time. It was a cool evening. And the windows were frosted up. And I was nipping on this 3 pints for the price of 2. Just a beautiful time. And here I was, and the car ran better. And I sang for a little while, oh, promise me. And I talked to myself and won every argument, you know. None of you folks have ever done that. God was in his heaven, and everything was all right. And I got up to a little town called Cleveland, Texas, to get out and get a chaser for one of these jokes. And as I returned to the automobile, one of the damn cats got out. And I knew that I dare not go home without him. And I chased him all over this little town. It was raining hard by then, the mud. It was a stinking mess. It really was. And I finally caught him under a cotton gin and took him back to the car and held him by his hind leg and whipped him all the way back to the car. And I threw him in the back seat of this hot automobile. And he did a thing back there that wasn't nice. It was a sort of a Picasso study in brown, really. Imagine the little hot automobile with the windows closed and the heater going, and it didn't bother me a bit. And I proceeded north. Still singing, oh, promise me. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I threw up in the front seat. Windows still closed. Heater still going. Bother me a bit. What are the lines? He cannot tell the truth from the false. He thinks he's leading a perfectly normal life. At daylight, I pulled over to the side of the road in a very small town called Alto, Texas, and it had 2 big street lights down through it, and I pulled over under one of them to take a little of my breakfast. And there was a town clown there, door rattler, constable of sorts. And I guess it was his first chance to make an arrest in many days. And he came rushing out to the car. And he rapped on the glass. And he said, let that window down. And he shot his head in the window and he said, what do you think you're? Oh my God. And he slowly walked away. That after we enjoy the fruits of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to its fullest and stay for a while and become a new person, we forget what it was like. So I beseech you, and I admonish you, if you please, that when you put your arm around the old drunk that comes now and smells a bit, he don't know how he feels. He cannot distinguish the truth from the false. And the responsibility is yours from there on. We don't bring him up to us. They came down to get me. And this is the true story of our society. Well, from then on, then it got bad. And later on I had been a representative, and you know the word, they call it lobbyist, you know. It's a real dirty word, but that's just what I was doing in the state capitol in Sacramento for one of the largest unions in the country. And there came a big crisis there, and we were trying to get a law passed that had to do with a lot of employment in the railroad. And I was unable to function in a job that I had been given the responsibility to function in. And it was beat me in the assembly. Have you ever had those congressmen and assemblymen to say, "Yes, we'll vote for you"? And in the final count, the lights would go on and they'd turn their head. They voted no. You've seen it many times. Which truly makes me use the term that government is the last refuge for the incompetent. But they beat me. They beat me. And this is the common cry of the alcoholic. I think there's a certain amount of paranoia in all of us. That's a term. You don't know paranoia. You got no one. Listen, we got professors down in Texas University that can't talk half as good as you do. Don't you ever get it. You quit right where you are, boy. You got everything it takes, and then some. I left California, and I love to use these terms, they sound so antiseptic, a thoroughly discredited man. This is another way of saying they ran me the hell out of the state. And I used to say, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, after getting run out of California and getting run out of Texas and getting run out of everywhere that I ever was, the first psychiatrist I ever visited said to me, "Did you ever feel unwanted?" And I did what countless thousands of others of alcoholics have done. I went back to that stinking hometown to die. No joke there. This is the bitter truth. I would have gone anywhere but back to my hometown. But it was the only place I had left. And this is the beginning of the end for me. And I went back home. This is the city slicker, the boy from Beverly Hills, the fellow that knows all the answers, the resourceful man. He's made good in the city, my mother used to say. And my great return to Tyler, Texas, my mother had me locked up. And this was a very cruel and insidious blow. Here's a guy that had all the answers, come back to my hometown, and these people don't appreciate me to have me locked up like this. And I suppose if a person was capable of bitter hatred, I had it. Hating my own mother for bringing this great humiliation down upon me. Hell, it wasn't my first jail or my last. But there was something particularly cutting about it. to come home, and your own mother blows the whistle on you. It's not good. And I stayed in there. I had been on a steady diet of, phenobarbital and Gallo wine, and letting those run concurrently. And I was not a good fit subject for society, you know. We talked, and I used to have company at home when my people didn't have it. I'd visit with my company, and they looked at me with amazement, and other things too. But I was bad about having company. Psychiatry has a term that a man becomes beside himself. And I was. Hello, Joe. How are you? Yes, fine, you know. Who are we? We don't need anybody. You know, you read the advertisements today in the recreational vehicles. I just bought one. And everybody makes the same boast about one of these vehicles. They say it is a self-contained unit. Hell, that's what a wino is. When you see him walking down the street, he's there. That's him. He's got everything that he needs. The perfect costume, overcoat and tennis shoes. And I used to carry a can opener in my coat pocket. And we used to, you know, you can steal these cancer fund cans off of the bar, take them out in the attic, cut them open, get the change, and come right back in, spend them in the same place. It's a nice deal. But he's a self-contained unit. He's one. One. And whatever you say to him, unless it's what we've got, it'll never drag him forth from the chilling vapors of loneliness that all of us have experienced. Bill had to fly every word, but I think that was the greatest he'd ever had. To experience the chilling vapor of loneliness, to be one. It's a horrible thing to be one. That's the reason that we're all sitting here together today, is because we're no longer one. Loneliness is one. And this is the greatest mastery of this society and these principles that we have to live by. There's a dispelling of loneliness. We don't have to be that way anymore. Here I am in jail, hating my own mother for having me put me there. I don't know how many days I was. There's no time in the life of an alcoholic. Preachers get up behind these podiums and talk about a nebulous thing called eternity. If you've ever looked in the dictionary, you'll find that eternity is described as an interminable length of time. And if you've ever woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning in the same state that some of us have, do not have the strength to stand on your feet, you don't have the price of a drink, you have to sweat the hours out from whatever time you awaken until the bar opens, you are well acquainted with eternity. There's not a drunk in the room that doesn't know about an interminable length of time with no beginning and no end. Life of an alcoholic. About the fifth or sixth day, there was a fellow who came to my cell whom I'd never seen before, and he asked me by name. And he said, "My name is Morris, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to use a word here, if I may play upon the English language. And I hope if I don't say anything else here today that you'll remember the one word. He came unsolicited. And I'm here today because he came unsolicited. And he stood there and told me all about himself. And tell me about me. If he'd have got over in me, it could have made him react. If he'd have got over in me, it'd have had all the answers. Told me all about him. And he used the word frequently in his dissertation, and he said, "We found from our experience." And we found from our experience. And I thought, "God damn, quit it." We have found from our experience. And he stood there, and the thing that ruffled me, I don't remember many of the things that he said, but I was subconsciously so enviable of the fact that he could stand still. Stood there like that. We found from our experience. We have some principles that you can live by. You don't have to be like this anymore. Made me all the promises that are afforded me in our book of experience, and just stood there still. And he likes to drive me mad because I don't stand still. I'm a Libra. Like this. Did you ever see the picture in the magazines of the bridegroom carrying his bride over the threshold in his arms like that? I used to do that to people on the street. Leap up in their arms. You know. And this guy stood still. And I couldn't ruffle him. I cut at him. And I said to him, "Who sent you to see me?" And this is who I particularly wanted to hurt and to hate. Interfering with my business. My private business. And if I remember correctly, he never used the word alcohol. Talked about problems with drinking. I had a terrible problem with my drinking. Told me what he did. He was a man who was a real big executive in our school system. In charge, literally. He was the business manager for the Tyler Public School. Had closed up his office on Monday morning, if you please, the busiest day of the week, to go see a man that he didn't know. Unsolicited. If you folks had waited for me to call this drab, uninteresting, coffee-drinking, bunch of cake-eating bastards, I'd have died. You know? And there seems to be an erroneous idea floating around this society. Our public relations says that we operate on attraction rather than promotion. But that ain't what our staying alive policy says in the first paragraph of chapter 7 in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. He said that practical experience shows that the surest immunity against drinking is extensive work with other alcoholics. Then he added, this works when all other activities fail. And then there's one of the shortest sentences in the book, with the second of only two exclamation marks, it's in the book of experience. Unqualified and unequivocally, it says, carry this message to the alcoholic. That's too damn simple for you to screw up. There ain't no way you can mess that up. No matter how hard you work on it. I get tired of these people that coming up with new things in AA, you know. Have no basis in fact. They talk about somebody gets up and says, "Well, alcohol was only a symptom of what was the matter with me." I cannot ever remember a policeman beating me over the head and locking me up in jail and saying, "Mr. Lee, we're locking you up for the symptoms." We're locking you up for drinking alcohol, per se, period. This is what we're locking you up for. This is my illness, alcoholism. Then some more terms. Predisposed tendencies. We put that on the turnip down in East Texas. You ever have any predisposed tendencies? I've never been locked up for them yet. Never went to the hospital with them. Always went there shaking and puking from drinking alcohol. And we got to doctor it up, you know. And I went to a psychiatrist one time, and he used some of this bad terminology on me. Said, you got a syndrome. And I thought a syndrome was a cat house where they competed. I didn't know. He said, you got a syndrome. I thought, God, how lucky can you get? A lot of people work a long time to get a house like that. He gonna give me one. All the fancy trimmings. What did Dr. Bob say to us in his last message? Keep it simple. Let's not become interested in things that are only appealing to the intellectual mind. I believe he was trying to use the word extraneous and never got around to it. Keep it simple. I'm an alcoholic. Pure and simple. I have proved that by drinking alcohol. That's how I know I'm an alcoholic. Through the lack of art in my drinking. And this guy saw when he was talking to me that he wasn't getting nowhere. Still couldn't rubble him. Still couldn't rubble him. And he stood there just as calm, and he'd drive you crazy. You ever have anybody that had that much self-containment? And I was a long time in AA before I discovered the word serenity. This cat had it. And he turned and left. He gave me a little pamphlet that had been written down in the South in those days. That is before we had all this stuff coming out of New York. And on the front of the pamphlet read, slaves of drink, find peace of mind. Have one here in my pocket. And it was written by two losers. One of the fellas that wrote it died drunk. A doctor. And the other fellow I saw not so long ago, paddling around, still eating his pill. These fellows wrote that pamphlet, slaves drink, find peace of mind. So it behooves me to say, who are we to say how we're going to get well? If you're sick, you just do what the doctor says. And what the doctor says is outlined in 186 pages. Of a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what we do to get well. But you know, when he left, I never could erase it from my mind. There was one question that drove me mad. Nobody had ever got the best of me. Man, I stayed in there punching until I got even with you. And I kept saying to myself, why did he come? Why'd he come? And the more I thought about it, the more I prayed on it. Didn't bother about what he said. Why did he come? I ain't figured that out yet until I read the lines in our book, It Comes of Age, and Bill expressed them when he was standing in the foyer of the Mayflower Hotel. The impetus that put this society into motion. After he panicked at the thought of going into the bar, and then he thanked God for the panic, incidentally, and we never did that very often. And then these words came out. Bill said, suddenly I discovered that I needed him more than he needed me. This is the foundation of this society that we inhabit. It is the emphasis that put it into motion and has kept it in motion until today. The passing of the package, one to another. And I'm so glad that God intended for this thing to work so strenuously that when he had put it in our fumbling hands, that no matter how many mistakes we made, it kept floating. And this is the magnificence of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't get even with that guy. He's one up on me. I didn't want anybody one up on me. What'd he come for? And my people shipped me back out of town again. They hired two deputy sheriffs and loaded me into a police car and took me to Houston and sat with me in the depot until the train went west. Keep him moving. That was the treatment for alcoholism until the advent of this great society. And in the next 5 months, with all the jocularity and all the fun we have in looking back upon the ridiculous antics of an alcoholic, I can honestly say to you, the next 5 months I literally went through hell. And I drank as few people have and never tell the tale. And one night, in a flop house in Upper K Street in Sacramento, I opened up one of my old bags, and it didn't make any difference which one I seemed to open. That damn pamphlet was on top. Slaves of drink, find peace of mind. Slaves of drink, find peace of mind. I didn't read it. Didn't have the courage. I didn't want to know about me. But I knew where the answer was. And I think I did. Very undramatically, I think I uttered the life-saving words of the alcoholic. God help me. There's nothing so spectacular about that, is there? Other than the fact that we have to give up to win in this society. We have to give up to be a survivor, to be here this morning. And I suppose those are the magic words that we use for the beginning into this great travel of ours. God, help me. That's all. And I got up and crawled out of there and walked literally 2,600 miles to find that stinker that gave me that pamphlet and the fellow that stood still. I wanted to get even with him. And I found him. You know, that's a hell of a dramatic story. It'll bring the tears to your eyes. I made a few bridges and a few jails in that trek. And would you believe that it just shot my ego out of the saddle to discover that there was an AA group three blocks from where I started. That'll knock your story all to hell. And he took me to my first aid. This guy that came unsolicited to visit a guy he didn't know, because he felt, like Bill, that he needed me. And I thank God for that need. And I still repeat the lines in the first paragraph, chapter 7. That if you get worried about yourself so much, and your problems seem to be overwhelming, the surest immunity against drinking is extensive work with other alcoholics. I didn't live happily ever afterwards. I remember that meeting. I got 2 weeks. I knew every damn thing there was to know about AA. I became a saint, if you please. I even quit cussing. And they called me to go see another drunk. And I was so filled with, what is it I was filled with? Don't you tell me. But I went to see this guy, pick him up, and he was in a bar, and somebody had taken his jug, and that's all he really wanted. But I was so godlike, I couldn't see this. And I took another buddy with me and put him in a new automobile that I had, and we went and recovered his jug and put him between us. And I drove real slow and gave him an eloquent pitch. Now, I remember how good I felt. I just was beside myself with piosity. And I told him about this great thing. And his eyes began to water. And I knew I was getting him. And as I further elucidated upon this great program, he gently lay his head upon my shoulder. And I knew I had him. Did you ever hear of a drunk puking silently? Every time I've ever gotten godlike with a drunk, he puked on me. You know that? But I don't know how long you hack at this thing, how long you fool with a drunk and say, this great thing we used to hear so damn much around there, he ain't ready. How the hell do you know what he's ready? Who gave you the great virtue? He ain't ready. I'd be dead if they said that about me. He ain't ready. I got a call one morning to go out and see a drunk, a puking, stinking drunk. He looked like me. He was scurvy as hell. He was on the verge of DTs. And I loaded him up in the car and went and borrowed a goblet of whiskey and poured it down and knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshuffled from the drink, he was in the AA club. And I wouldn't give up on him. I went back. I was determined that he was going to sober up under my direction. If this thing I had was beautiful, he had to have it. And I go get him again, get him sober. 3 months. Drunk. And I wouldn't give up. And I worked with him for 4.5 years. And he would go to faraway places and call me Collect. To tell me that and I prayed about it. God knows, and I made a side project out of him, and I'd say, dear God, you've been watching them sparrows too much to let me have this one. I'll have it. But it kept on hacking. And about 12 years ago, he got on for him what was his last drunk in one of our local motels. And he called another fella from our club, and he went out and talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he never took another drink. And I hated his guts. I'd look at him in the club and say, you ought to be mine. And if I know anything about the treasure that God gives us, when we come to this society, I owe him more than he owes me. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. Church community against drinking. Extensive work with other alcoholics. This works when all other activities fail. No way you can screw that one up. I want you to work on it for a while now and then come back and give me your interpretation. Carry this message to the alcoholic. That's hard to screw up. And I suspect that some of us are here this morning, as dear Bob said, because somebody took the time to love us a little. And I think if there's anything that is in the alcoholic society, It is absolute infinity of God's love. We know more about that in AA than any other facet of society. I boast and say that when we find a society and begin to live by its tenets and within its bountiful gift of love, that we live better than anybody else. Don't you believe it? And there were two things that Bob and Bill never disagreed on. They fussed a little with one another. Some of the things they disagreed about. They were two different entire personalities, and this was one of the things that made this society function. But there was one thing that they both talked about, lived with, and gave to us. And that was the power and the efficacy of prayer. And I suppose one of the greatest forceful movements in this society and ever is where it taught us to sort through prayer instead of people. Sought through prayer instead of people. I think we're the luckiest facet of society that exists today. There's a little Catholic monk that was in a monastery, and he wasn't a quick thinker. And he couldn't master all the given prayers that they'd given him. They had a prayer for this, and a prayer for that, and a prayer for this. And he just couldn't hack it. And it bothered him that he couldn't master all the prayers. And he came up with a brilliant idea. He said, "I can beat him. I'll just pray all the time. Then there will be no beginning and no end to this prayer. And that's the way I'll do it. Pray all the time." And I think that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a necessity of our illness, even condemns us to perpetual prayer. We start the day, God help us, to say, over today, huh? God help us say the right thing to that drunk. God send us a drunk. And if we stay in the program with its 12 tenets, the first thing you know we're doing, we're praying all the time. The prayer has no beginning and no end. The prayer of AA. God help us. God help me to help you to help me. This is the beauty of the whole thing. I don't know how to express gratitude. I'm ashamed to even try. To the gift of life, to the gift of my presence, for the gift of knowing you, for the gift of the possibility of learning to love you. One of the greatest gifts that's ever been given. Maybe I can explain it by telling a story and we'll go home. That came out of another book. This was a book and a little occurrence that happened some 2,000 years ago. And this is the story of the demoniac. Most of you have heard it at your mother's knees, your scripture students. And this is a story about a nut like us. It says in the scripture that this man talked in the vain babble, that he was so wild that no man could tame him. And that the manifestations of his illness, and it uses the word disease, were so forceful that they had to run him out of town. It's kind of like me. And he ended up out on the riverbank, eating with pigs, kind of like me. You can see the picture, if you can see me. Filthy garments, the idiocy of the language, the crying out in the night, like me. And there seemed to have been, at that time, a little carpenter fellow who was traveling around with somewhat of a new philosophy of love. And this little carpenter fellow had a facility that we in AA have not quite acquired yet. He could see no ill in anyone. And he went to the nut and he said, "Say, fellow, you're having a little trouble." And the fellow in his self-pity cried out, "Trouble is my name. They call me Legion, which means many. And the little carpenter saw that the man needed great help. And those of you who know the story know what took place. And he condemned the evil spirits to leave the sick man, and they were put over into some pigs that went down into the sea and were drowned. And that's not the end of the story. In those days, the pig business was big business. And there were some stool pigeons around. And they ran into the town. They told these people that owned the pigs. They said to them, "You're out of the pig business." And the people were incensed. And the story goes, they rushed in mass out to see what had happened to their livelihood. And as the story goes further, it says that they were incensed and prevailed upon these two to leave. Said when they got there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. We've got a step like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. There he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. These people prevailed upon him to get out, to leave the country. They were more interested in the loss of the pigs than they were in one feller getting well. Believe you me, the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of a great throng of people who were interested in one feller getting well. This is the way we operate in this society. We can't get past that idea. All these people that are sitting here this morning, one at a time. How many of you folks came on the bus load? One at a time. And they prevailed upon them to leave. And I can see this nut. I know how he felt. Coming from this hellish existence that he had experienced and not having the chance to enjoy the fruits of another. And he was afraid. He was timid and afraid. And the only thing he knew was what his sponsor told him. It's the only faith he had. It's what he told him. And when these people were putting the pressure on him so much to leave, he looked at this little carpenter and he said, "Let me go with you." And the little carpenter broke a rule for us. Most of the time when he'd done any good at all, he told the people to go on, forget about it. Don't say anything about it. Don't say a word. You're blind, now you see. But he broke a rule with this guy. He said to him, "What I will say to you this morning, stay here, so that others can see what has happened to you." Thank you very much.
Folks, will you please stay until we close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Joe, I don't have the words to express our feelings to you. There's just a couple little things I must take care of. First, I want to thank you for coming to Akron, Ohio, becoming a part of our lives, and you'll remain so. You'll never be Wino Joe to me again. You'll always be Joe Lee. And I'd like to present you with a little token of our appreciation for you coming here. If I get the wrapping on. And it says, in grateful appreciation to Joseph Lee for his outstanding contribution to the Founders Day Breakfast Group. June 26, 1977, Akron, Ohio, 1935 to 1977. Yeah,